From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, in the Time Warner dispute with Channel 4, who's losing the PR battle?
I think most people probably blame both, although certainly the cable company has been the company you've loved to hate for decades. So, yeah, there might be a little bit of a PR disadvantage there.
Later, how Wisconsinites view the state's annual wolf hunt. Dining critic Ann Christensen spotlights some overlooked bargains in Milwaukee.
That's what I like to find, are these places that are kind of like little hidden gems or secrets. Maybe even they're holes in the walls in some cases.
And a compelling what-if story lies at the heart of the latest novel by Andrew Sean Greer. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for listening today. Time Warner cable subscribers in the Milwaukee area have been missing a key local part of their cable lineup for nearly a month now. A dispute over money has meant that Channel 4, WTMJ, owned by Journal Broadcast Group, is not being carried by the cable company. For a while, there was basically nothing on the station's position on the dial, but suddenly, last week, channel surfers who landed on Channel 4 got to see something like this.
It's time to play Family Feud! This is Joey Fatone from Universal Atlanta Resort in sunny Florida. And now,
yes, instead of WTMJ, it is now the Game Show Network that you'll find on Channel 4. Rich Kirchen has been writing about the dispute for the Business Journal of Milwaukee, and he's in the studio to discuss the latest developments. Hey, Rich, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Mitch.
This dispute between Journal Broadcast and Time Warner Cable is obviously about money, but money's always been at stake between local stations and cable companies. Why has it come to this point at this time?
Well, you know, it has a lot to do with who's getting squeezed financially and when. If you go back to 2006, the television networks, in the case of Channel 4 in Milwaukee, that's NBC, started to, prior to 2006, the television networks actually paid their local affiliates to carry. So Channel 4 was getting money from NBC to carry their programming. In 2006, the network started to say, gee, our revenue's being challenged right now. Our audience is starting to shrink. Advertisers are spending money in other places, specifically the internet. We're going to start charging the local stations to be an NBC affiliate. So Journal Broadcast Group in Milwaukee owns Channel 4. They have to pay money to NBC since 2006. And also around that time, the local TV companies then, or owners, turned around and said, hey, cable company, you know, you've been carrying our station for free. You know, Time Warner Cable never paid anything to carry Channel 4 or any other Milwaukee station until 2006. So now the last half dozen years or so, companies like Journal Broadcast Group have been paid by the cable companies, such as Time Warner, and the satellite companies to carry their station. So that's become a revenue stream for the likes of Channel 4.
Is there any requirement that cable companies carry local stations?
The way it works is, and local stations want to be on cable and they want to be on satellite. The procedure is they petition, so to speak, the cable company and say, look, we have an audience out here and you have to carry us. It's a must carry. Then the question comes down to, how much do you pay to carry the station? And what's been happening is companies like Journal Broadcast Group are looking at the same thing the networks were looking at a few years ago and saying, more advertising money is migrating to the digital space. Our audience keeps shrinking. There aren't nearly as many people watching Channel 4 or NBC as there were 10, 20, 30 years ago. So we need to get revenue from somewhere else. So we're going to ask the cable company, we're going to tell the cable company, we need more money from you.
And in this case, the cable company has said, in the case of Journal Broadcast, has said no.
Correct. And this comes at it after a number of years where the cable company has continued to, you know, I call Time Warner Cable every year, both as a consumer and a reporter, and say, why are the rates going up? And more often than not, the answer has been because our programming costs are going up. And the main driver of that really has been ESPN. ESPN has been able to get huge increases from the cable and satellite companies because there's only one ESPN, and there are all these ESPN networks, there's ESPN2, ESPNU, et cetera, et cetera. And the cable companies and satellite companies have not been able to say no. For whatever reason, they're drawing the line in the sand now with Journal Broadcast Group, which has four Time Warner markets, Milwaukee, Green Bay, Omaha, and Palm Springs, California, and more notably CBS Corporation and the stations they own in New York, Los Angeles, Dallas, and other places.
And there was a curious development that happened earlier this week, or maybe it was late last week. Time Warner took a network that it already offers, the Game Show Network, and moved it to Channel 4 on basic cable packages. What is the message that that sends?
It's take that, Journal Broadcast Group. Take that, Channel 4. You know, we can do whatever we want. Not only do you get Game Show Network now on the standard cable, Channel 4, if you go to digital cable, 1004, you get nothing. There's nothing there. It, like, takes you to the channel guide. So they're playing hardball, no doubt about it.
Well, and assuming, and maybe it's foolish to assume, but assuming this eventually gets resolved, how seriously do you take Time Warner's claim that the Game Show Network will be on cable channel 4 for the long run?
Well, yeah, I wrote something on our website last Friday that initially said permanent based on the wording that Time Warner provided to me, which was Channel 4 and Journal Broadcast Group gave up, quote unquote, Channel 4 on cable. And then I ran with that and said, you know, it's a done deal. And then Time Warner said, well, it's long term. It's long term that Game Show Network is on Channel 4 on cable. But, you know, they said they would reevaluate, assuming that at some point they reach an agreement.
Lots of local TV viewers, especially people trying to watch Packers preseason games, are frustrated. Are there any indications of who they're blaming for this?
You know, I just talked with Steve Wexler from Channel 4 and Journal, and he hears mostly from people who are rooting for Channel 4. He surprisingly hasn't been getting a lot of complaints. You know, who do you blame as a consumer? I think they're both getting it. I mean, I think most people look at it as, you know, I'm paying to get cable. I want to watch the game or whatever else on Channel 4. Why can't I get it? You know, and I think most people probably blame both, although certainly the cable company has been the company you've loved to hate for decades. So, you know, there might be a little bit of a PR disadvantage there.
At the same time, I would imagine Time Warner at this stage anyway figures that that Channel 4 still has the most to lose in this dispute.
Well, there's no doubt that in the short run, it's going to be 4 weeks this week since Channel 4 has been on Time Warner Cable. You know, initially, where Channel 4 gets hurt is not only do they lose between 25 and 50% of their audience, depending on the show, they can't deliver the commercial time to advertisers. And in the first week or two, they're able to do make goods. You know, they're able to say, well, you had a one-third smaller audience on the Packer game, but here, we'll give you some time on the 10 o'clock news. But at some point, certainly after 4 weeks, that starts to hurt. They can't do that. So they're losing revenue from advertisers. Time Warner, though, in the short term and long term, this is not good for them. Certainly, there are a few subscribers leaving. They're not saying how many, and we don't know. But that's an issue. On my block, the AT&T U-verse sales reps were going door to door last week, and I don't think that's a coincidence.
Steve Wexler has certainly been in the public eye more in recent days than at any time in the recent past.
Yeah, well, he's been general manager of TMJ TV for a number of years. And really, I mean, even in my dealings with him, he's always been very close to the vest and, you know, no comment more often than not on whatever I call him about. And yes, he's been the public face of that station and of that company throughout this dispute. They've taken a very public approach to it.
Is it safe to say that public reaction to this whole kerfuffle would be stronger if this were the regular football season and the issue involved Channel 6?
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah, no doubt. So, you know, preseason games, you can watch them on Telemundo on cable in Milwaukee. And if you know Spanish, great. If not, you can turn down the volume and, ironically, listen to the radio broadcast on TMJ Radio. But September 5th is the first NFL on NBC game. It does not involve the Packers, but that is the NFL games on NBC are some of the highest rated, most watched TV programming every week during the football season. So, you know, the stakes will definitely get higher over the next week or two.
Well, and one imagines that the same holds true for the CBS stations in these large markets, which also carry NFL games during
right.
the regular
season.
Right.
They have NFL two games every Sunday.
Any signs that any moves are being making? Any closer to an agreement?
No. I reported last week one day that there had been, you know, I got this from Steve Wexler, there had been some back and forth, quote unquote, like they were communicating at least. And then within a day, you know, the door slammed shut again with, you know, Game Show Network on Channel 4. And then, you know, the back and forth argument was back in place.
Rich Kirchen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Rich Kirchen is a senior reporter for the Business Journal of Milwaukee. You can find a link to some of his coverage of the Time Warner cable dispute with WTMJ Channel 4 from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Wisconsin's second annual wolf hunt is scheduled for October. What do people here think of our coexistence with a formerly endangered species? One researcher has gauged public opinion in Wisconsin, and we'll learn more after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. There's a lot going on in the world of the gray wolf. In Wisconsin, the second annual wolf hunt season begins on October 15th. Nationally, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced plans earlier this summer to lift the gray wolf from the threatened and endangered species list throughout the country. That's already happened in Wisconsin. UW researcher Adrian Trevis is intensely interested in the fate of the wolf. Trevis has studied the carnivore's interactions with people for 15 years. He's also done surveys to learn about people's attitudes towards wolves in this state. Today, Trevis's team releases a report on public opinion on the state's first wolf hunt held last year. He shared some of his findings by phone with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz, starting with his view of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposal. Trevis was a co-author, along with colleagues at Michigan Tech and Ohio State, of a scientific criticism that outlines two key concerns.
One of them is that the Endangered Species Act is meant to protect threatened and endangered species across a significant portion of their range. And currently, gray wolves are only recovered in less than 20% of their historic range. Therefore, we don't feel it meets the Fish and Wildlife Service decision does not meet the delisting criteria that are in statute in the Endangered Species Act at a national level. The second reason is that the justification the Fish and Wildlife Service gives for that delisting is not based on the best available science. In fact, it ignores the best available science relating to human tolerance for wolves. And I can quote directly, but I'm going to paraphrase now, that the Fish and Wildlife Service argues that current range of wolves, such as Wisconsin and our neighboring states, as well as the Northern Rocky Mountains and some neighboring states, that current range is the only suitable habitat. And other states that don't contain breeding wolf packs are unsuitable habitat. Now, why do they argue that? Well, our reading of the Fish and Wildlife Service notice points out very clearly they believe the rest of historic range for gray wolves is unsuitable because people have lower tolerance for wolves and will kill them, will do so illegally and not tolerate the presence of wolves. However, over 100 studies of human attitudes towards wolves suggest the complete opposite. Namely, that tolerance for wolves is higher outside of their current range, that majorities support wolf recovery outside of their current range, and within wolf range, our own research, especially that research done here in Wisconsin, indicates that tolerance is lower within wolf range than immediately outside of wolf range, and that tolerance has tended to decline over time. So those results and over 100 peer-reviewed scientific studies contradict the Fish and Wildlife Service claim that most of historic range is unsuitable habitat for wolves. based on human intolerance. We've presented a formal scientific criticism of the decision to delist at a national level.
Have you heard anything back?
Well, we don't expect a direct response from the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're not obligated to give us a direct reply. However, my colleague John Vucetich, who's one of my co-authors, was on the peer review group convened to comment scientifically or to provide a scientific assessment of the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision. And as you followed in the news, he was one of the scientists who was removed from that peer review panel because his analysis of the decision showed scientific evidence contrary to the proposals of the Fish and Wildlife Service. And it appears that he was removed for presenting those opinions. So it's disturbing to scientists like myself and others I've been talking with that suggest that political forces are interfering with what's supposed to be a scientific process with lots of integrity, or we thought it had lots of integrity.
So what does this mean to Wisconsin?
Okay, so for Wisconsin, the take-home message is a little different because as part of the Western Great Lakes region, Wisconsin's wolves were removed from the federal list of threatened and endangered species in 2012. The Western Great Lakes region includes all of Wisconsin and, in fact, south into portions of Iowa, Illinois, portions of Michigan, as well as Minnesota. So ordinarily, we would be outside of the process and unaffected. However, a federal court case brought by the Humane Society of the U.S. precedes the June 2013 Fish and Wildlife Service notice. So the Humane Society of the U.S. is litigating in order to prevent the delisting that affected Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. So we're likely to be influenced by events happening at a national level, and not for the first time. It's been since 2003 that Wisconsin's wolves have been subject to what we're starting to call the roller coaster of federal protections, removal of federal protections, and then reinstating federal protections. We anticipate that this latest drama in the federal delisting story, namely the drama that started with the June 2013 notice and the removal of scientists from the peer review, that drama is going to trigger even more scrutiny of the Fish and Wildlife Service's decisions process. And whenever there's been scrutiny in the past, we've seen litigation brought by pro-wolf interest groups. And in fact, the record of that litigation is it's unanimously in favor of the pro-wolf groups. They have won 5 out of 5 federal court cases relating to wolf delisting.
Over your years scientifically looking at people's perceptions, there's been a general trend toward accepting and wanting wolves to be part of the landscape?
Well, there is a lot of diversity out there, but we still find a majority having a positive view of wolves and supportive of their recovery. But there is that important caveat, Susan, that you alluded to, which is that the recovery of wolves has to be on human terms, and it has to be in the right places. There are places that are really inappropriate for wolves to be living because they're going to come into serious and severe conflicts with people. And nobody, there were at least not in our surveys, nobody is approving of wolf recovery in such places. And that goes along with strong support for lethal control of wolves that attack livestock and strong support of protecting health and human safety. But besides that, there's a lot of available habitat for wolves in many states in the United States. So the Fish and Wildlife Service decision to remove federal protections for wolves throughout the historic range seems to be excessive. It's like sweeping one's arm across a map and saying all of these areas are unacceptable without allowing the citizens of a state to determine that for themselves.
Wisconsin is approaching its second hunt.
Yeah, starting October 15th, 251 wolves are slated to be taken by hunters. Our research indicates two things. One relates to public opinion, and the other one relates to sustainability of the current hunting quota. So let's start with public opinion. With my colleagues, Jamie Hogberg, Brett Shaw and Lisa Naughton out of University of Wisconsin-Madison, we conducted another public opinion survey this summer that aimed at getting the opinions of people both within Wolf Range and outside of Wolf Range in Wisconsin. And we found, although there was approval to hunt wolves, to designate them as game, two other factors suggest caution in how that hunting season is implemented. There's a lot less approval for certain ways of hunting wolves than we've seen in the past. In particular, we're getting majorities opposing the use of hounds in hunting, opposing hunting pups, majorities opposing hunting at night, and majorities opposing hunting during the breeding and pregnancy seasons of wolves. Those results are strongest outside of Wolf Range, but we see even within Wolf Range a 5 to 7% increase opposing all of those hunting rules I just listed. And that says to us, although the Wisconsin public in general, as a majority, supports wolf hunting, we're seeing a strong increase in opposition to particular ways of hunting wolves. And as for a scientist like myself who studies policy and management interventions and how they're designed, that tells me that the design of wolf hunting in Wisconsin has not been receiving majority support as we might expect in a democratic system in which wildlife are a public trust resource held for current and future generations. The second aspect of our research is about the sustainability of the current Wisconsin wolf quota. 251 wolves represents a little more than 30% of the late winter wolf count reported by the DNR in April 2013. That places Wisconsin's wolf quota the highest on record in North America out of 21 different provinces and states that hold wolf hunts. So Wisconsin is taking what I call an aggressive wolf hunt, and it's also in using methods that are poorly understood and opposed by big chunks of the public inside and outside of Wolf Range. And we have to ask the question, is this an appropriate design for wolf hunting, given public opinion and given scientific evidence of sustainability? So we examine the question of sustainability, and we find that there's an extremely high likelihood that by April of 2015, the wolf hunt will have to be closed because the wolf population has declined so much. They may even have to be listed by the state as threatened or endangered once again. And in all of our scenarios, that happens by 2016. So in my scientific opinion, the current design for Wisconsin's wolf hunt is not sustainable beyond 2015. Often flies in the face of public opinion of how wolf hunting should be done. And it's also presenting a risk, maybe a small risk, but it's a real risk, that we drive the wolf population so low that it can't recover, and that the federal government has to step in again under the emergency relisting rules of the Endangered Species Act. And I think that's an outcome that virtually nobody in Wisconsin wants to see happen.
University of Wisconsin Environmental Studies researcher Adrian Trevis and master's candidate Jamie Hogberg will be sharing the results of their public opinion survey on Wisconsin wolf policy with a DNR advisory committee tomorrow in Wausau. The survey was released today, and Trevis spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. So you collect the loose change in your car and from under the sofa cushions, we'll talk about your best dining options with that loose change. That's Cheap Eats when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's more of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Not to get personal, but how much money is in your wallet right now? Let's say you have 25 bucks. That might be enough to have a pretty nice lunch or even a decent dinner someplace in town. Our dining contributor Ann Christensen says, believe it or not, maybe it could get you a couple of nice lunches or dinners. And we're not talking about fast food or the buffet restaurant or even the church supper. Christensen, who is a dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine, compiled a diverse and sometimes surprising list of cheap eats, which makes up the cover story in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. She tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon that the list is constantly evolving.
I've done this story many times over the years, and I will tell you that it's getting harder and harder to find the under $5, wow, that's a great cheap eat. It tastes really good. It is good. You know what I mean? It's not like super horrible, low quality ingredients, something that you wouldn't want to put in your body kind of thing. You know, I mean, it was getting really, really hard, tough to do that, to find those things. So we kind of opened it up a little bit more to, you know, things in the $5 to $10 range too, but something that has enough substance to it, size and satisfaction. You know, I mean, it's ultimately, if it's not delicious, it wasn't going to be in the story. I don't believe that there's anything at Old Country Buffet that is a value, in my opinion, according to my definition. So don't look for Old Country Buffet in the story. It's not there.
Or any buffet, really. There is a mention of where you shouldn't go, and one of them is an all-you-can-eat sushi special. Yeah.
No, I'm, by my nature, suspicious of buffets, which is not to say I haven't been to them. I certainly have, and I'm sure I will go to more in, you know, over time. But I don't really – the premise to me is – I mean, I don't seek them out.
Let's go right to that page that I'm flipping
through
here.
Let's put it that way.
The one where you talk about what you shouldn't buy cheap.
Oh, that's – okay.
Let's start
there.
Yeah,
right. You want to start right there. What not to do.
And, of course, I just mentioned the – all-you-can-eat sushi. And actually, I did go to an all-you-can-eat sushi place in Alexandria, or is it Arlington, Virginia? And it was great, but it wasn't $5. It was mm-hmm. maybe $20.
Right. From, you know.
But, I mean, it was really wonderful.
Did they cut you off, though? I mean, did they say, did they stipulate you can only order as much as you can eat? They may charge you for food left on your plate.
Yes,
extra
they did.
Food.
They did do that.
Okay.
But that wasn't a problem.
No.
For
I'm
me
just
anyway.
Saying that I've seen those things too where they'll say, yeah, well, you can get as much as you want, but you better stuff it down.
You better eat what you take.
Yeah.
Which a lot of us grew up with.
Right.
So it's that was no big deal to me.
Yeah, but then there are people though that would say, oh, can I take this home? Can I take that home?
What about, well, there's other things here, and you say discount steak night, pasta night, and desserts. By desserts, do you mean like a dessert tray, you know, where you have this huge selection?
Yeah. Well, okay, so pasta night, the implication being that you're not going to get some deliciously beautiful gourmet type of pasta with, you know, some scallops on there for $5. I mean, think about it. You're just not. And probably more than likely you're going to get overcooked pasta too. It's not going to be like al dente, some really thoughtfully cooked thing.
Not,
you know,
artisanal.
No. But if you're okay with that, you know, if you do Prego over, you know, pasta at home all the time and cook it to within an inch of its life, I think that's fine. No, I'm joking. But I think that, you know, you at some point when you go really, really cheap, you sacrifice quality.
Well, okay. One more thing not to buy cheap, because this really caught my interest, which is the saucy specials, which you made it sound like, well, If it's covered in a sauce and it's really cheap, it might be, you know, yesterday's leftovers.
Yeah. I mean, yes.
Or even more.
Absolutely.
Than yesterday.
Right. I mean, and, you know, I don't know the truthfulness of that across the board. Again, I want to hope that that's not the case. But, you know, you think about bread baskets. Back in the day, all those bread baskets that nobody eats any of them and all that bread becomes, I don't know, bread pudding or I don't
croutons,
know.
Croutons, maybe.
Croutons, right. Which isn't such a – that's not a terrible thing, I don't think, croutons, that sort of idea. But I don't know that – you know, I don't really want to eat leftovers made into some kind of fricassee or whatever the case might be. You know, you just don't know, I suppose, how old some of these things are.
All right. Well, let's switch to the positive part of our interview,
yes.
Which is what I liked is that there was a lot of variety. These aren't just, first of all, there's no fast food. There's no what we would consider to be chain fast food anyway. There's just an amazing amount of restaurants here that have, either it's a cheap, something they'll have on a night that's cheap,
yeah.
Like Mussels, they might have a special.
Right.
or it's just something that's always on their menu. Like someone could have, like you mentioned, tacos. So
yeah.
what's a standout, first of all? What do you think is the biggest surprise so far?
I'm always looking for good Thai food. And there's a place on 91st and Brown Tier called Thai Bangkok that I think does a good job with their Thai food. And it's pretty reasonable. I mean, it's pretty much most things are under $10. Again, we're not in the $5 mark there, but good Thai food, really well seasoned, spicy if you want it to be. So I guess there's little things along the way that I thought, wow, that's great to find that. I don't know that I went to any place and thought, this is mind blowing. I mean, but there are certainly things that are really, exciting to find. For instance, Pacific Produce, which we've written about a couple of times. It's an Asian grocery store on the South Side. You can go there and get a huge banh mi sandwich for $3 or a little over $3. That's a great cheap eat, something like that. And when you go in and you find something like that, you think, wow, this is awesome. I'm going to go there every day for lunch. I mean, you don't, but you think that I know if I want to get a really good sandwich, it's hard to find a good $3 sandwich,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, on Mitchell Avenue, Ann Mall, it's a Pakistani restaurant, which, I don't think gets a ton of play. You don't read about it a lot, but it's another place where you can go and get really, really delicious kebabs. They have little chicken sandwiches, but they're kind of wrapped in roti or paratha. Again, really, really reasonable, $5.50, something like that. Delicious. If you want mutton, you can go there and get mutton. Really nice Pakistani food. But again, it's something that maybe you wouldn't know about because it's not something that people write about all the time. So that's what I like to find are these places that are kind of like little hidden gems or secrets. Maybe even they're holes in the walls in some cases.
Or in the back or side of grocery stores, like you just mentioned, Pacific Produce is part of a huge grocery store.
Yes, yes. Which is in the similar situation to El Rey, where you're going to an Hispanic grocery store and they have a little restaurant inside where you can get great tacos. It's hard to argue with their tacos either, which are like a dollar each or something, close to $2 rather, for their tacos. Great. And that's on a daily basis. That's not a taco special that they're doing.
And I mentioned before there was no fast food on here, but Cops, I guess, falls into the category of fast food, but they're a step up.
I got to say, I'm not a fast food person. I don't do McDonald's. I don't do Arby's. I don't do all those places, but I do Cops. And, I think they do a really good job on what we would call Milwaukee fast food. A burger, fries, some of the best onion rings that I know. That's a great cheap eat.
We're here talking with Ann Christensen, Milwaukee Magazine, about Cheap Eats, the August article that you put together with a lot of help, including me. You asked me what my cheap eat favorites are, and I don't even remember what I told you, but I think a couple might be in here. You also talked to chefs in town, which I thought was interesting to get their take on what their favorite cheap eats are. Any surprises there? Anything interesting?
I always like to ask chefs that question or about any kind of restaurant question because it's interesting to know where they like to go. These are people that know about good food, and they get a day off here and there. And I've heard that a lot of chefs say, I don't feel like cooking when I'm off, So being a chef, oftentimes you don't have a lot of money. It's not a huge, have a huge salary there. So I queried a couple of chefs and called them and said, hey, where do you like to go when you're not on duty? And not spend a ton of money. So, for instance, Nell Benton, who's the owner and chef over at the National, said she really likes to go to Benji's and have a corned beef sandwich, which Benji's to me is something I grew up on, matzo ball soup and corned beef or pastrami. That's what I grew up eating. And I love Benji's. That's great stuff. Talked to the chef of Pizza Man, which is probably one of the busiest restaurants in Milwaukee right now because it just opened a few weeks ago. And I'm guessing that Zach Baker doesn't have a ton of time off right now. He's the chef there. But he likes to take his wife, or he and his wife like to go to a restaurant on the South Side, a Mexican restaurant called El Señorial, which is a great place. It's like on South 30th. It's kind of in a, off the beaten path location, but great authentic food. You go in there and you hear more Spanish spoken than English for sure. And just a fun place to go. And again, you don't spend a lot of money and you get great food. Their breakfast especially, I think, is really good. Mexican breakfast there.
Something else, a little side that you have in the article itself is on wings.
Yeah.
Taking flight. So there's more of a selection here than I thought. I don't really think of Milwaukee as a chicken wing town.
Wow. Well, I got to tell you, the thing is, we have a couple people on staff that love wings. And if we have an editorial meeting, they will say, we got to do a cover story on wings.
Okay.
They want a cover story. And they still do. They still want this. And it's great. I mean, I obviously had to look into how many places are serving wings. I've certainly had my fair share of them over the years. It's hard to find a bar that really doesn't have a wing night. I'm not kidding you. Or have wings in some form on their menu. But having a wing night is very popular. And that is sure to bring in a lot of people that are going to, you know, if it's like 25-cent wings, 40-cent wings, you come in and have a bunch of beer and some chicken wings. But as you know, just like anything else, the quality varies. So it seemed like we had to send somebody out, and we did. Our editor, Christina Douglas, went out. She's a big wing fan, and she, you know, went to a number of places and was checking out their wing selection. And what's cool, too, about wings is a lot of places are going to give you a selection of sauces and spice levels and all of that. So so that makes it kind of fun. And then right. You've got boneless versus the bone-in wings and – So, but we went specifically, I need to stipulate here that we went specifically with wing night, so wing deals. Because you can definitely go to some places and find, you know, a $10 small plate of wings on their menu, but we were looking for places that were doing deals, the best deals.
All right. If you want to eat cheap, should you be looking for nightly specials? Is there a way to gauge all that?
I think sometimes, yeah. I have to say that, you know, some of the places in town that are a little are considered maybe more high-end, like Braze or Hinterland, they have their own bar specials. They tend to be in the bar, in the lounge, something like that. But, you know, let's say you want to go out and you want to, you know, dress up and be a little more stylish or something, and you want to go to one of these restaurants because it's one of your favorites, but you don't want to spend a lot. Absolutely, you're going to find oftentimes some great special on a certain weeknight. You know, for instance, at Braze, where they do their mini burgers with the chickpea fries, is a great special. You know, that's $6 for that. Have a nice cocktail, and you're not spending a lot of money. So, yeah, I say look at bars. And even, you know, like I said, higher-end restaurants and bars, oftentimes they're going to have them have some kind of deal in the lounge or something on a weeknight. Or just great ethnic food. But you won't – it's not always expected where you're going to find it, and that's what I like about it.
Well, the last thing that I want to bring up is something I have always thought of as a cheap thing to eat. Depends on where you get it, of course. Pizza. I mean, there aren't many – I mean, there's a lot of ethnic food here. And, of course, I don't think of pizza as ethnic food anymore.
No.
But there's only a few places that you recommended for cheap eats. I mean, it's cheaper if you have two or three people and you get the same thing and divide it up, I guess.
You mean
at a regular pizzeria.
Specifically.
Right.
Right. Well, we went with By the Slice pizza, or like let's say a mini pizza, because By the Slice you might spend $3 to $4. That's not much, and if you get a big slice of pizza, that's a meal, right? You've got everything there. You've got the carbohydrate, the protein, fat, you know, everything that you need. So yeah, we were looking at some of the best in terms of, you know, By the Slice and mini pizzas. I really like the mini pizzas at Glorioso's, really delicious, piled high with toppings. Classic Slice is, you know, sort of is a pizza we've mentioned so many times, but I'm always surprised that when I get a slice there, the size of that slice of pizza is the length of my forearm. You know, it's a huge slice of pizza,
yeah.
But you know, and again, that one you can doctor up a little bit more and you're going to be spending maybe $5 or $6, but there are quite a few options in town where your $3 or $4 gives you a really nice slice of pizza.
Okay, Ann. Well, keep the quest on for finding cheap food. Is this going to be a regular yearly?
I would doubt yearly, but it's definitely something we'll revisit because it's a cheap town, Dan. No, we like cheap food. A cheap, good food.
We know a value here.
Yes.
Yes. All
right. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, Ann.
Ann Christensen is dining critic and senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine and our regular dining contributor. She talked with Dan Harmon about this month's Cheap Eats cover story. You can find a link to it from wuwm.com/likeeffect. Part do-over, part what-if, part time travel novel. We'll learn about Andrew Sean Greer's latest effort after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Most of us have what-ifs, kind of fogging up our lives. What if I had taken that journey? What if I hadn't broken up with that person? Sometimes the answer is that things would be far worse, but sometimes they'd be far better. And the kicker is, of course, we have no way of knowing how they actually would have come out. Greta Wells, the title character in the new novel, The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells, is given the chance to redo, to fix her life. Thanks to a faulty or maybe even enhanced course of electric shock treatment, Greta finds herself moving in and out of other timelines. How she comes to understand herself and those closest to her through this time shifting is Andrew Sean Greer's way of exploring what one person might do if given the chance for a do-over. Greer is the best-selling author of The Confessions of Max Tivoli and The Story of a Marriage. The book tour for his latest book brought him to Milwaukee earlier this summer, and he told Lake Effect's Bonnie North he wanted to use time rather than place as his way into this story.
I think most of us think, oh, I'll go to a different place. But that's how I'll fix it. And so I guess my thought in this book was, if you weren't to a different time, would that fix it?
Or would that make it worse?
Would it make it worse? Because a couple books ago, I had a book, Confessions of Max Tivoli, set in Victorian San Francisco, and interviewers would always ask me what time I'd like to live in. And I would try to answer the beginning of the 20th century, but then I thought, well, I'd like to bring everyone with me. I don't want to be alone there. And then I thought, well, a lot of my friends, they wouldn't have a really great time. I mean, my female friends couldn't vote. You know, I don't think it'd be great to be a person of any color except as white as I am. And that made me think, like, well, there's not really a great time for everyone in the past or even now.
Right. I think there's a line in there where, and we were talking about that before the interview began, where Greta says, somebody asked her, is there ever a time for us in this particular, wherever she is, you know, that was ever good? And she says, well, no, not yet.
Oh, it was heartbreaking to write that, honestly. Except I know that there is one. She hasn't lived it yet because the book begins in 1985. So it's already set in the past, her present.
What made you start there? Why start in 1985 and have these other times as opposed to starting now in 2013?
Right, that would be the normal thing. I mean, it's not exactly a time travel novel. And if you pick it up thinking that, it'll confuse you. So free that from your mind.
Yes.
But normally, if you're going to move around in time, you start in the present. But I somehow got it in my head that it'd be even more fun if her present was a different moment. And then I realized that 1985 kind of reflected moments in 1918 and 1941, which are the other two eras she visits, much more than the present. Mostly because it was times of war and plague, because of the AIDS plague going on, and change in women's lives and freedoms that interested me much more than the present day.
And that makes sense. That absolutely makes sense. And how she discovers what those freedoms are and how it's not necessarily the one she thinks that she's going to find or the restrictions that she's necessarily going to find.
Well, that was the other fun, because it'd be easy to say, like, oh, it's terrible in 1918. But actually, in my research, I was finding 1918 was particularly liberating. Even though women couldn't vote and everyone was about to not be able to drink and there was a terrible war and the Spanish flu, it actually looked like a really fun, free time in Greenwich Village.
Why do you think? What was going on specifically that made that happen? Because the Greta from that time certainly has what seems to be a lot of freedoms that we take for granted now. Freedom of movement, freedom of, you know, who she wants to be with and how she wants to do it.
For some reason, I think it was a generation that was reacting to the 19th century and was throwing off all of those. I mean, corsets were already gone by 1918, and that sort of says a lot. And also, men were gone. They were at war. So it was a lot of women just there running things. And in Greenwich Village, it was, for some reason, one of those moments, like the 60s, I think more than the 1920s, it was a moment of total free love. Like exactly what they meant in the 60s too. And they used that term and wild new ideas. They wanted universal health care in 1918 and thought they were going to get it. And they didn't get it until, well,
kind of now.
Kind of 2014, maybe.
Yeah, but of course, in Greta's timeline, it didn't happen at all. It hasn't happened in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
One of the things that you do, you said at the beginning, you know, if you were able to go to a different time to try to fix whatever you needed to fix, but you'd want to take your friends and your family with you, and you achieve that in the other timelines in certain ways. And it's interesting how her twin brother Felix shows up in the different timelines, how his lover Alan shows up in different timelines, and also how her aunt Ruth either is there or isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were thinking about these characters and starting to figure out what they were doing and who they were going to be in the different timelines, how did you decide? Did they tell you where they were going to be, or how?
That is such a good question. I haven't had to answer something like this yet. Well, in a lot of it, I let myself a lot of freedom in this book to just write and see what happened, which was possibly a terrible mistake, because once I'd made this giant mess on the floor, I had to give it a structure of some kind, which was what took the most time. But I did find that I wanted, for instance, her Aunt Ruth. Well, I guess I had this idea that some of us would be indomitable and not be changed by the times we're in and not be moved by those motions. And that most of us, I think myself included, would be shifted just by the time we live in and kind of go along with things. Like everyone now pretends that if they were there at the time that they voted for Kennedy, although we know almost half voted for Nixon, or possibly more than half, you know, at the time. But no one admitted it. They want to be on the right side of history, but they're just moved along by it. And I think like her brother Felix, who is a lot like me in the book, is not really strong enough in a way, but Ruth is. And I think it's because the women, the people in my life I know are like that and who have suffered for it have all been women.
Suffered for what?
For standing outside their time and not doing what would be normal to do, or having the normal opinion and shifting that opinion to the new normal opinion. They always had what turns out to be the right opinion, but they're Cassandras the rest of the time.
And that's an interesting mythological figure to invoke.
I guess.
Because, of course, nobody believed her,
and
she suffered terribly for it. There's some suffering, certainly, that happens. And I'm thinking Ruth is one of those characters that doesn't change. I mean, she is who she is.
Yes.
It's kind of like wherever in time she would show up, she is who she
is. Well, I even made her – I tried to have her talk the same, basically, and not have kind of funny things to say in 1918 that were of their time, but just be the – dress the same, have the same haircut, all of it.
Be the person she is.
Be that person. And I guess – because I was asking myself, like, who am I really? And what parts of me are just sort of added on by how I've grown up and the culture I've been in? Like, if you really strip me away, what would I be? And I have the luck of having myself an identical twin, and I can see what someone who starts off with incredibly similar DNA, how their life is and similar upbringing, how it can shift even there. Although I admit I live next door to my brother. We have very similar lives. But that sort of thought experiment about what is the essential part of me, and I thought with Ruth, all of her is what you're seeing is exactly who she is.
What price does she pay for that?
Being an outcast and being alone, really. But also what she gets to me is freedom, although there's some tragedy in there too.
And what about Greta? Because it's through her eyes that we see that this story unfolds. I mean, Felix, her twin brother, is an essential part of that. And of course, so are these other characters. But it's her story. It's her grief and sorrow that sort of kicks all of this off.
Well, because in a way, she at the beginning of the book, she's been stripped away of everything. Everyone she loved and depended on, and is at the beginning feeling like there really is nothing to her. And I think it is her journey to see what is consistent about herself day to day. But I think what she also finds is that she's not consistent. She's made up of all these different kind of people who are like a colony working together to be this woman, Greta Wells, especially because she's aware that there's other ways she could have been.
We haven't mentioned probably one of the most important characters in the book, and that is New York, and that is Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
And in all three time eras, it's the same place. It's the same apartment building. It's the same apartment. in its different guises. But New York itself and Washington Square and that whole area, and anyone who knows that area has a mental picture of it anyway from whatever time they spent there and whatever era that was. But there were times when you were describing being out on the street or going somewhere or whatever, and I could smell the air. I could feel it. I could feel the sidewalk. And I thought, how wonderful to bring along the place in the time as well, not just the people, but the place.
Well, I guess what I wanted, and now I've written three basically historical novels, so I don't know what I'm up to here, but in each one of them, I would do all this research and then use almost none of it. I would use things I made up because I have no evidence of how each time smelled. But having read it all, read newspapers and pamphlets and people's memoirs, I could imagine it, and I thought, well, that is my job as a novelist, not to report the research I did, but then to imagine something that's lost forever. And there's a moment in the book in 1918 where she looks up at the sky and she sees the Milky Way. And of course, in New York, you cannot see the Milky Way.
Not now.
Right now. And I don't know. I assume you could have. It was a moment where it occurred to me, oh my God, there were so few lights in those days that you could have seen stars, and how sort of sad and beautiful that there was a time when you could have done that. And that's something that is just imagined, but is the fun part.
So what is it about historical?
My best friend asked me this 6 months ago. He said, are you going to write another historical novel? Because I don't want you spending 6 months in the library. He said, I think you should try the present day. And I am, actually, what I'm working on now. But I think previously I had always, I'm a fiction writer because I actually don't want to write about myself directly. And I think I set things in the past because I don't want to write about the present day directly because I can't process it very well. Even though I can sit with my friends and process what's going on and I know pop culture and politics and things, somehow I can't quite create the world I'm in. And it's like sort of looking at, you have to look at Medusa through a mirror, not directly at her. It helps me a lot. Once I set something in the past, it suddenly is wide open for me and fun.
So is it more difficult writing the present day thing you're working on now for that reason?
You know, it's somehow fine. I'm doing okay. But because I'm not trying to capture, the job is to not get today right because I'm going to get it wrong. I mean, that's what I learned about reading newspapers from the past, is it's hilarious that it will say in 1952, world ends tomorrow, big sale Tuesday. They can't both be true, but it's holding contradictory ideas about itself at the same time. We really don't know what the future is or what's important right now.
Thank you, Andrew Greer, for writing The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells and for stopping by today.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Andrew Sean Greer is the author of The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells, published by HarperCollins. Greer was in Milwaukee earlier this summer on a book tour, and he spoke then with Bonnie North. What if you hadn't tuned in at 10 o'clock this morning? All of us who produced this show would have been just a little bit crestfallen. And likewise, we sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. I'm Mitch Tyke. We are here every weekday morning at 10 with Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.